Welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast, a podcast incorporating narratives about facing and navigating adversity, a mixture of people, their experiences, and professional psychological discussion. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo. I'm a qualified and regulated psychologist with over 20 years' experience of mental health, disability, and human behaviour. I want to share people's stories of navigating adversity in the hope that through being heard, a dose of compassion and some understanding, we can help others in the face of adversity too. Hi, and welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo, and I was really excited today. I have Dr. Kirsty Harris with me, and we are going to talk about endometriosis, aren't we? So I'm going to say hi and let you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are.
Hello. I'm Kirsty Harris. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I have just written a book about endometriosis. I have endometriosis. I had adenomyosis, and I had a hysterectomy and excision surgery 3 years ago now, and then came to write a book about coping with the disease and the impact it has psychologically as part of the ACP Coping With series.
So we've had another psychologist on before with the same series, so it's really lovely. There's a group of psychologists who are writing books based on lived experience, which I just think is fantastic. So I'm gradually getting you all on, and we're getting your stories out there. We were just talking, weren't we, before we hit record, it is quite nice to hear psychologists also talk about their lived experiences of things. I think there's a nice cultural shift there. And I'm really excited to cover this topic as well, because I also have endometriosis as well. So first time I have self-disclosed on a podcast. And that's why I was really excited to get you on to get talking about this. So what I'm wondering is, can we start? People might not know, what is endometriosis? Because that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? If you haven't come across this term before, you've heard it, but you don't really know what it is it something we can define?
Yes, definitely. So endometriosis is a whole body condition. So it can impact the whole of your body in all different ways. And it's where tissue like the lining of the womb, but not the actual lining of the womb itself, but very similar tissue is found in different parts of the body. And that can cause pain. It can cause issues with inflammation, and a whole range of different, often rather difficult symptoms. There can be a cyclical nature to it. So often it's thought of as a period problem. I did debate calling my book Problem Periods, because that's what I thought I had for a very long time. But actually it isn't just periods. It's much, much bigger than that. And although it can have a cyclical element for a lot of people, myself included, it becomes not cyclical and pretty debilitating on a day-to-day basis.
Glad you brought that in, because I think that's really important, that sometimes, and that's a really good phrase actually, that kind of, you know, it's just a problem period. It can be really minimizing, can't it? And it's all right to say as well, sometimes people in the medical field can refer to it as that, and it's life-altering, life-changing. Can be debilitating, and if you're doing a job like we are, really impactful in terms of how you work, how you think, how you parent, how you live your own value-laden life as well. Is it all right to bring in, because this is really interesting, when we obviously had our pre-chat before doing this podcast, people used to talk about stages, and I am guilty of this. I'll bring in why in a minute, but could we kind of talk about how it used to be defined and how things have changed?
Yeah, I mean, people do still talk about stages. So there's sort of a bit of disagreement around this in some ways. But I think it's important to understand, because if you think you have endometriosis, or you know that you have endometriosis, you'll go online, like most of us do. And what you'll find is a lot of people in support groups, or perhaps resources online, that will say, oh, I've got stage 4 endometriosis, or I've got stage 2 endometriosis. And that very quickly is sort of linked to the severity. So if you look at some of the guidelines, particularly guidelines in America, they have stages. They classify the disease according to different stages. And a lot of places will still do this. If you see a consultant, you have a laparoscopy, they may still tell you, oh, you were stage four or stage two. But the NICE guidance has changed. And it suggests actually that staging classifications can be unhelpful to people living with endometriosis. The reason being that the stage of your endometriosis doesn't correlate with the impact that it has on you. So there can be people out there with stage four endometriosis who don't even know that they have it. And there can be people out there with stage one endometriosis who are very debilitated by it. And that can be for a whole host of reasons. So NICE suggests that actually moving away from a classification system and going towards a sense that everybody's experience is valid and that everybody is impacted in different ways is a more empowering and helpful way of making sense of the disease.
Which makes total sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The reason I was going to bring in as well is I've always used the phrase, I've got stage four, because for so, so long, symptoms were minimized. You kind of felt like it was you, you're not coping properly, you should just be able to suck it up and get on with it. So kind of having levels on kind of, in one way for me, helped me to help other people to know how difficult it was. But I also get actually that there can be people who don't even know that they have it. And that's, I think, something really interesting to cover today, isn't it? That, you know, how do people get diagnosed? How do you help the medical profession to really understand if you're going with symptoms, for example? So kind of moving away from something I've been talking about recently, you know, kind of medical gaslighting or minimizing, maybe people that generally don't understand the condition as a GP. What's the best advice for people? If there's someone listening now thinking this might be me, are there kind of ways that we can help people understand our experiences and get that diagnosis?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're at the start of a real shift in terms of gynecological care generally, but certainly endometriosis awareness. The answer to sort of how do you get diagnosed, I think for the past few decades, I would say, is with great difficulty. So when you were saying, you know, I would say to people I'd got stage four endometriosis as a way of trying to get them to understand what it was I was experiencing. For me, I didn't have a confirmed diagnosis for 20 years. So my symptoms started when I was 12, when I was 33, when I knew for sure what stage it was and all of those things. So I had 20 years of not really knowing what to say to people. And being able to say, oh, I've got suspected endometriosis, or I think I've got endometriosis. But for a lot of those years, just saying, I've got a problem with my periods, which, to be honest, you didn't say to anybody if you could avoid it. So it's really difficult. The average journey to diagnosis is 8 years in the UK.
It's a long time, isn't it?
It's a long time. And for a lot of people, it will have been longer than that. And also it depends how your symptoms present, because it is a whole body disease. So it could be that it's on your bladder or on your bowel, or you could have thoracic endometriosis, or, you know, just it's impacting you in some other way. And that can also take a lot of time. And I think, you know, you touched on the term of sort of people being dismissed, and there's this idea of medical gaslighting there, and people talk a lot about this on social media. But for me, like, I don't think that was anybody's intention. And I personally have a degree of discomfort with the term gaslighting for that reason, is it sort of implies that there was intent behind it.
Good point.
But actually, I think for most of the medical professionals I met, and certainly anybody else I met, they genuinely didn't know. Certainly didn't know what endometriosis was. Some of the medical professionals I would have met, some of the GPs I met, wouldn't have even known really what it was. Certainly wouldn't have known the breadth of the impact that it can have. Perhaps would have not related some of the symptoms I had to endometriosis. Because a lot, like my first lot of symptoms were all to do with my bladder. And I don't think they would have made that link necessarily. So there's just a general lack of awareness. And one of the big campaigns at the moment by some of the endometriosis charities, and it's Endometriosis Awareness Month. So anybody on social media will see this. But just asking the question when you go to the doctors, could it be endometriosis? So that it starts to sort of trigger that idea in people's minds. And if perhaps your GP doesn't know a lot about it, that they can liaise with a colleague that does.
Like kind of that it's all right not to know, but it's listening and hearing and kind of navigating that together, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between saying, I don't know what's wrong, or I don't understand what's wrong, and therefore there's nothing wrong, and perhaps you're stressed, or you're not exercising enough, or you need to do more yoga, or you have a low pain threshold. I was told all these things. Low pain threshold. Too tall, I was told at one point. I don't know how that related to.
So interesting. Yes, because those that might not see me standing up, I'm fairly tall. I've had that too. Yes. That's so interesting.
Maybe you're not eating the right things. Maybe you're not sleeping well. There's a difference between saying, I don't believe what you're telling me.
Yeah.
And therefore, I'm going to find another explanation. And I believe what you're telling me completely. I just don't know what it means.
Yes. Yeah. That kind of curious stance rather than being kind of closed down. Are you comfortable telling us, would it be useful to tell us a little bit about your journey? Because what was particularly that prompted you to write your book, which I'm so excited about?
So the book came about after I'd had my hysterectomy. So I had my hysterectomy and excision surgery when I was 33. And after I'd had that, things did improve for me really significantly.
Okay.
I had a massive reduction in my pain. I now have days where I do not have pain, which I hadn't had for a very, very long time. I'd got a better understanding of what had happened to me and what was wrong and how to manage it. And it gave me a bit of time to think about that journey and what that had been like and what helped me. And then this opportunity came up through ACP to write books. They were looking for proposals. And I thought, actually, I think this would be a helpful thing to put out there. There wasn't anything like it for me 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And there still is very, very little on the psychological impact of endometriosis. There's not psychologists embedded within the endometriosis care. Not everywhere even has specialist endometriosis care, depending on where you are. So we're a long, long way away from having really psychologically informed services for endometriosis. And it felt like I could offer something to that conversation based on my own experience. And it does come with the caveat that this is my experience. There isn't a massive evidence base of what's the right therapy or the right psychological approach. This is what I used, what I found helpful based on the evidence in other areas, which was compassion-focused therapy.
Yeah.
And I kind of took that and applied that to myself and adapted it. And it seemed to make sense to put it into a book. A bit like you, I'm also a great believer that I think as clinical psychologists, it's good for us to share some of our own experiences and our own struggles. I don't think therapists are immune to struggle or distress. But I also think that sometimes a one-to-one therapeutic relationship is not the place to have that conversation. And there's lots of times in my career where I've been sat with somebody and thought, perhaps my experience could be helpful to this person. But it's very rare I've actually shared it in a one-to-one therapy kind of setting. And this again felt like a way of sharing that that was more, in some ways, potentially more appropriate for people, that they can pick and choose whether they want to access that or not. And it doesn't shift the focus of therapeutic work. Obviously, if it comes up, they can ask me. I'm happy to talk about it. But it just felt like a different and hopefully better way of doing it.
Yeah, that's what resonated with me actually, is that getting that balance, it is hard. We have to obviously have professional boundaries and ethics about what we share and then what our patients ultimately might, or clients might be holding of our stuff. But it's wonderful that we have this different way now of bringing out, sharing information with others. And one of the things that really struck us, obviously we've had a pre-conversation, haven't we, is about, obviously you use compassion focused therapy and you've adapted this. Do you want to tell us a little bit about, because it's the, we talked about tricky loops, didn't we, when we had pre-chat. Tell us a little bit more about that, about how we can start to think about the kind of psychological impact of having this really, you know, impactful condition.
So I think some people will know about compassion focused therapy anyway, but this is a model by Paul Gilbert. And the evidence base continues to grow for this in a whole range of different areas, but particularly in health and health related conditions. And there's a huge amount of resources from the Compassionate Mind Foundation and people like Chris Irons, all of whom I'm really thankful to for supporting this book and idea. But one of the ideas that really resonated with me from this work is that we have kind of an old brain and a new brain. And our old brain is that more reptilian part of us, more animalistic part that will respond to threat, whether we want it to or not, it will respond. And it's also very aware of things like social rejection and judgment. We want to rely on and belong to a group. And I think that was one of the things that took me a long time to understand, is why I was struggling so much with some of the things that I was struggling with. And I think a lot of it related to shame. There's a lot of, we talk a lot about period stigma.
Yes.
You'll see this in the media. But underneath, I think, period stigma and some of that research is shame, and feeling quite ashamed of that. And I, you know, grew up at a time where period education, menstrual health education was very limited. All of our sexual health and reproduction lessons were limited to that. I was educated under Section 28. So it was all about reproduction, and that was it. And you were separated, boys and girls, for that.
Yeah, I was too.
So there was lots of threats in the system about what it meant to have a period and menstruate, and didn't really want people to know about that. It wanted that to be kept away from other people. So all of those things can kind of activate that old brain sense of, there's something about this that's unacceptable. So Paul Gilbert calls that kind of idea of shame existing in the world as an undesirable self. And I think there was something for me about having a period that was undesirable.
It's a useful way of thinking of it, isn't it?
And certainly undesirable to others. And you can kind of probably do a whole podcast on the cultural differences in how periods are perceived and how people can be treated during their menstruation and all those things. But it really resonated with me about why this activation of threat and the physical old brain response of fear and anxiety is so pronounced. And then you have your kind of new brain, which is your thinking brain. I call it thinking brain. But the part
of you, it's a handy way for people to think about it, isn't it, actually?
Yeah.
To listen to this new concept for people.
The part of you that can engage with imagining and ruminating and trying to make sense of. So, you know, you might have, for me, the example that I use in the book is bleeding. So, and one symptom of endometriosis, and not everybody will have all the symptoms, but I did have this one, can be heavy bleeding, much heavier than you might get in a typical period. And that heavy bleeding can be very sudden. So if I was, for example, around the time that I was expecting my period, if there was any indication that I thought I'd started bleeding, I would become really anxious to that. Because of the worry that the blood would show on my clothes. And not wanting that to be seen and sort of not wanting to be found out on that. So I would, if I had any kind of feeling like a cramping, for example, that might be one of the things that would warn me that I was going to get my period. So if I had cramping, my old brain would react, because that's a kind of threat, there's a pain here, something's happening. And my new brain would say, you're going to bleed. You're going to start bleeding. Your period is here. And if, and then that would obviously make my old brain more concerned. We must react. You know, I could feel my heart racing, feel myself getting more tense.
Yes.
Feel a kind of flee response, wanting to get out of a situation very quickly. And then my new brain is going, where's the nearest toilet? What clothes am I wearing? Can I put an extra layer on? Can I tie a jumper around my waist just in case? You go round and round and round that cycle with this sense of fear of the situation that you're in. And the thing about that is you may not be getting your period. The thing about tricky loops is it's all about getting caught up in something and a fear of something that is real in the sense that your body is reacting to it in a very real way and your distress is real and the impact it's having on you is real, but it might not be that you're actually getting your period. And I think that's the impact that endometriosis had on me, was a relatively constant anxiety of what was coming next, what was going to happen, what impact it would have on me, my career, my relationships, my life, as it continued. And unfortunately for me, like lots of people, it got worse and worse as time went on.
And what that does to those tricky loops.
Yeah. And the idea obviously behind the book is the ability to unhook yourself from this. And first notice them. I talk about this over and over again in the book, is you've got to notice it first. You have to know what's happening, because for me there was a long time of not knowing what was happening physically or psychologically. Didn't know what was happening in either domain. Once you know what's happening, then at least you can understand it. And that, I'm not claiming that anything that people do from the book or go away and do in therapy or anything like that is going to make it all go away. Endometriosis is an incurable condition at the moment. Hopefully it won't be forever, but it is right now.
Yeah.
You do have to learn to navigate it. It does have an impact. Can't minimize that. But the idea is that if you can understand it, and if you can have some skills that might help you to navigate it, then it may be that you can have an impact on the amount of distress that you feel. Yeah. Because of it,
that kind of taking a little bit of the wind out of the sails when that tricky loop starts. I say that sometimes people don't think the understanding or the noticing bit is an intervention, but I see that as a intervention in itself, because sometimes it just takes a bit of the power out, doesn't it?
And sometimes it's all you can do.
Yeah
Like, you know, it's particularly in endometriosis, people often talk about flare-ups. And what they mean is these episodes that come on very suddenly and can be incredibly debilitating, painful, sometimes result in hospital admission. Some people will carry like a card that they can give to people and say, I'm in the midst of a flare, flare up. They can be really, really, when you're in a flare, all you can do is notice.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, that's not the time that you're going to maybe do some nice relaxing yoga stretches or put a podcast on or do whatever. You're not going to do that in that moment. You can notice it, and I think if you can use your breath in that moment to try and keep a degree of bodily regulation as you go through it, but sometimes all you can do is survive that moment and know what's happening and be able to potentially use some compassionate self-talk to know that it won't last forever, because when you're in it, it's really hard to remember that.
Oh, it really is. I've had moments where all you can do is breathe. You know, I've likened it to labor at times. It probably sounds really dramatic, but
no, I don't
at
think
times
so.
It can be that acute. You could be caught out somewhere and all you can do is sit and breathe, or lie and breathe, or fetal position and breathe on some occasions. And as you say, you might not even be in a position to explain to people what's happening, because you don't have the capacity to do that. And it's, isn't it so interesting, as we're talking about this, that nobody has written about this more, that, you know, how many people are affected by this condition and might be listening now going, this is me. or this is somebody that I know.
Yeah. I think it's a huge, huge number of people. And once you start talking about it, interestingly, my experience has been once I started talking about it and saying to people, oh yeah, I had this, a lot of people have gone, oh, me too, or my sister, or my friend, or with some of those things, maybe that could be me, maybe I could, that could explain what I'm going through. But the other thing about it is, and this is again why I think CFT is so good for this work, is it's about connection. And if, you know, shame drives disconnection. So if you're not talking about it, then everybody's kind of away in their independent little houses or caves or however you want to make sense of it. And you don't talk to each other, which then means that you can't connect and you can't care and you can't share. And you also can't go, oh, actually, yes, that sounds really similar to me. And use that information in a really helpful way. And we do that with everything else, like right down to how to make the best roast potato. You know, you'll ask different people and collate all this information.
It's a really good idea to share that metaphor, yeah.
But we do, you know, anything else, if you wanted to, you'd ask other people for advice and you'd gather it, and particularly as psychologists, like we're scientist practitioners, we're forever trying to find the next way of making sense of something or developing things or making things better. But if you have, you know, perhaps a degree of shame or self-consciousness or embarrassment around something, and you don't talk about it, you don't tell people, and then you can't sort of move forward with potentially support that other people. And you will also have experiences of telling people and perhaps that not being great. There's a whole chapter in the book about sort of how to talk to people and your relationships with others and different settings.
That's important.
How to do that.
Yes.
Yeah. Now I can say to people, I have endometriosis. And some people go, huh? And they have no idea what that means or what it is, or the impact it has. So when I had my diagnosis, in some ways you feel really empowered that you can now, like you said, you can now justifiably say, but I have it and I can prove it, and here's my surgery photos, which I do actually have if anybody wants to see them, just to prove that this actually happened. But then if that doesn't make sense to people, or they are uncomfortable with that discussion themselves, or, you know, for me, I think even now it comes up, I had a hysterectomy, so I don't have periods anymore. So if people think it's a period based illness and they go, well, you had a hysterectomy, so therefore you cured, but the hysterectomy is not a cure for endometriosis. I still have endometriosis, and I may well have more complications with it in the future. But that's, again, all of these things be really difficult for people to understand. It's an incredibly complex disease
and things that could lead to more invalidation, even if it's, you know, unknowingly so. That, you know, that, oh, but if you've had a hysterectomy, you're okay now, or you don't, you know, we naturally make presumptions, don't we? And it can be very invalidating, which can then add to sometimes you're not wanting to share. I mean, look at us today. So I was kind of do I bring this into a pocket? Is it all right to share? But actually, my kind of value about other people knowing, yes, look, we have two psychologists here on a podcast, both with the same condition.
Yeah.
Talking about it and being okay with that.
I think it's also just that acknowledgement that, like, you're not a worse psychologist because of it, or you know, not as good as a person or a woman or a mum or a friend or any of those things. Whereas again, I think it can get in the way of everything. And like my husband said, it's, you know, to some extent, it's like a third wheel in a relationship. You don't really want it, but it's sort of always there, just sort of lurking. And sometimes really, really dominant. And I think it was like that with my professional identity. You know, I didn't want to tell anybody about it. I was worried about what it would mean, what people would think. I didn't ask for a lot of adjustments that would have really benefited me at work.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I didn't ask for them. I didn't, any of the things that are out there to help people, like you're eligible for access to work, you can be protected under the Disability Act, you can have all like there's a lot of endometriosis friendly employers in the UK now. There's all these things happening.
Yeah.
But personally, I barely told anybody, let alone connect with some of the things that would have helped, because I was so afraid that that would be seen as a negative, or kind of get a little mark over my name that would be like a, oh yes, but she has endometriosis, so sometimes she's off sick, or sometimes she works from home, or
that reliability just made me think about how many times that I, over the years, maybe when I was employed in it, just triggered the sickness policy, because you had these sporadic days. They used to have rules, you know, if you were ill for a week at a time, it's fine, but if you have sporadic days, it used to set some algorithm off, and it was quite shaming then, because there was a kind of a hint that you're not doing something right if you're having these sporadic days, but you don't want to tell people why. Then the cycle continues, you know.
And if, you know, if nothing else, I hope that having information like this out there means that people can tell people, you know, that you can say, oh, actually, I do have this, and then, you know, give your manager the podcast or the book or the links to the resources that are out there now, just to enable people to have the conversation. And also, if it doesn't go well, which sometimes it won't, sometimes people are not compassionate, some people don't understand it. Some relationships do break down. Couples' relationships can sometimes break down. But also to know that that won't be every relationship that you ever have.
Yeah.
And it might have been tricky in this one, but it may not be tricky in another one. And there will also be relationships where you don't want to tell people, and that's fine too. It's just having a bit of choice. Whereas I think for me, again, in that tricky loop, I was in a real black and white thinking. It was either I was going to, I felt as if everybody that I ever came across ever was going to know.
Yeah.
Like I was going to have like a big flashing sign over my head. Or I wasn't going to tell anybody. And there was like no in between. So I think it's trying to think about actually what's going to benefit you, and where will having this conversation allow you to connect with a flow of compassion and help you, and where actually is it not necessarily, or you don't want to, and that's fine too.
Yeah, that coming back to self, because there's something really interesting that you cover in the book, this kind of relationship with yourself and others.
Yeah,
and we talked a bit about this in our kind of pre-chat, because you know, endometriosis can kind of take over, or it has to me at times, kind of your identity. Everything you do is planned around it, or just in case, or it can stop you sometimes leading a value-laden life, but also then the relationships with others. Is that something you can let us know a bit more about? So I just think that's a really lovely introduction for people, and kind of directly
to the and book. I had a big debate with the book around when I originally started it. It was like sort of about all the different symptoms and how do you manage surgery and how do you cope being in hospital repeatedly. And, you know, I wrote it, initially started the draft with quite a sort of medical standpoint on it.
Yeah.
And then I sat and thought about it and thought about it and changed it around again, and talked to people about it. And I thought, actually, for me, this book isn't about the medical treatments for endometriosis or the symptoms of it. It's about the impact that it has, and that's on, for me, was on my relationship with myself, my relationships with other people, and my relationship with the disease. And I think you know, you do have a relationship with the disease,
you
that
do,
kind of third wheel thing. And I think my relationships with other people just, you know, were impacted to varying degrees. I think a lot of it coming down to that fear of what other people would think or what it would mean, not wanting to let people down. So one of the examples I use in the book is, you know, my closest friends who knew about the endometriosis and knew about, you know, lots of that, they'd been there for some of the hospital admissions, they'd been there for some of the worst hospital admissions.
Yeah.
And they booked a really nice restaurant for a birthday of mine. And it was a, you know, big treat that they'd booked a lot of time in advance. And when the day came around, I knew I was approaching a flare, and I could really feel that I wasn't, didn't feel right and didn't feel as well as I would have liked to. But I also knew that I could manage it. When I look back now on the things that I did and remember how I felt, I really don't know how I did a lot of them, but somehow I did.
Incredible.
And I think that's the other thing about people living with endometriosis. They will do incredible things and you wouldn't know that there's anything wrong, but actually there really, really is. So yeah, they booked this thing, this meal, and I decided that I was just gonna go ahead with it. So I think I said to them something like, oh, I've got a bit of backache or something today. But I didn't want to cancel it because I knew they'd lose money. I knew it was a big deal. We all lived very far away from each other. Yes. So, you know, it wasn't like we could just do it the next weekend because everybody travels to meet because we don't live near anymore. And I just didn't want to cancel it. So I didn't. And we had the meal. But I remember feeling really unwell that day and it having a real impact. And I didn't tell them for like probably years after either. So it was actually when I wrote the book, I was like, I'm going to put this in the book just so you know.
Wow.
And they were both like, we had no idea. And what it made me realize is although I had done it and we did still have a nice time and, you know, it was still a very special experience. Actually, my friends afterwards were like, we now have a really different memory of that. Like we thought it was one thing and actually it was another. And that's not what they would have wanted. It's not what they wanted. It's not what they'd want in the future. And I think the ability to start to say to yourself, it's okay to make these changes and make these adaptations. Yes. Absolutely. Without completely withdrawing either, because again, for me, it would have been a polar opposite, either go and do the whole thing or not see them at all and be desperately sad for the whole weekend, probably not even want to talk to them on the phone because I would be so avoidant and so upset. And again, trying to find that middle ground of, you know, is there a way of maintaining this connection? And that is that compassion, because sometimes compassionate behavior is not doing what's easy. And you can be kind without being compassionate. So it's trying to do, actually, it might not be the easy thing, but the compassionate thing to yourself may be saying, you need to tell them the truth. You need to explain what's going on. You need to tolerate losing some money on this time. And not knowing if you're going to get this opportunity again. But that's what's needed right now. And it's a very, very difficult thing to do.
Which is why we need this book.
Yeah.
To help people start to navigate that and just understand the concepts. Those things take time, don't they? But just taking the time to just very gently understand the concepts is a huge, big step. And practicing that. And there may be days where we're not able to do it. And there may be days where we are. And that's all. That's all compassionate as well, isn't it? You know, that we can be kind to ourselves, whatever's showing up, whatever we're doing. I do a lot of acceptance and commitment therapy. And with my endometriosis, I almost have it a bit like an inner critic. It has an identity and sometimes it just has to come along. It's like you're showing up, so come along. And I think I shared this on another podcast, actually, but not in the context of endometriosis, that sometimes I can be doing something I really love. I love to dive. I love nothing better than being on a dive boat in the middle of the sea with loads of people and dozens of tanks. And it'll rock up then when you're about to, you know, jump in the ocean and you've got this horrendous cramp, but you can't tell everyone, hold on, just wait a minute. Let's delay this whole dive for 20 people. And it can be really debilitating, but you have to navigate that. It's like, come along with me then, you know, almost grab a tank because I'm going in that water and I'll do what I can with what I'm experiencing. Or I can just avoid altogether, which isn't me. It's really hard.
Yeah, it's trying to find a balance that's impossible. Yeah. But I think it's also, in order for people to navigate this personally, we have to be able to navigate it as a much wider society. And we need to be able to look at moving away from judgment in that. And it feels, you know, when I wrote the book, and I agree, I think ACT is also a great approach if people want to do further reading. But the book, my book, I really wanted it to be for people who didn't necessarily know anything about psychology and hadn't read anything. Yeah.
That's what I like about it. Yeah.
And it was really written. It was written for me 15 years ago, or my daughter in the future, or my friends.
Yeah.
That's who it's for. And my inner critic psychologist shows up and goes, oh, these are all the things that you didn't put it in, and all the theories that would have been helpful, and all the other bits and pieces. But that's why things like this are so important, these conversations, yeah. because Absolutely. Everybody around us also has to change and also has to come with us on this journey, because it can be. And, you know, a colleague of mine recently who has endometriosis and speaks about this, she had been to a big event and had, you know, done the presentation, everything in the afternoon, and had put that on her social media, and then got the train home, and then in the evening, or I think early the next morning, was in hospital. Gosh. And it's very easy for people to go, oh, well, it can't have been that bad then, or the speed at which these things change can lead people to not believe you. Or just fall back into that kind of judgment or lack of understanding. But it is like that. And the more people learn about it, and the more that we do say, actually, can I go later in the dive? Can somebody go before me? And the more we do that, then the more people start to realize actually what is going on. Whereas I remember, like, or I liken it to, my husband and I used to watch this program about the SAS. I don't know if you've seen it. I can't remember the name of it. Who Dares Wins. That's the name.
Yeah,
of
yeah.
So if anybody's ever seen this show, they get kind of ex-SAS soldiers, and then they get members of the public to go on it. And it's all like this endurance kind of test of them being put through this SAS thing. And I am not somebody that anybody would associate with any sort of exercise or fitness or anything. It would be almost to bring a smile to a lot of people's face if you imagine me doing any kind of exercise. But I remember specifically, like, thinking about all the things I've done in pain with endometriosis. And I remember, like, particularly I didn't know it at the time, but I'd had a cyst burst, and I'd got a chronic pelvic infection from that, and which then led to sepsis. And the day before I was hospitalized with sepsis, I took my two-year-old daughter to the park, which is about a 10-15 minute walk from my house, and I carried her back because she was crying, she didn't want to walk. And I remember thinking, just got to keep moving, got to keep moving, and carrying her all the way. And I don't know how I did that. And then it makes me think of, like, these kind of SAS programs, and people go, oh, they're so amazing and they can do it. And they are, completely. But there are women out there doing that day in, day out, on school runs, walking to the office, round the supermarkets. There are women doing that all over the place, and you wouldn't even know. And if they told you, you wouldn't believe them. And that's the bit that has to change. That when they tell you, you say, okay, I get it.
Yeah. And that did happen. That was a thing.
That did happen.
I had something just before Christmas in that exact situation where you kind of feel, would people believe if you say this just happened, and then you still went and did your clinic and did what you can. It's really hard, isn't it? Actually, I'd never thought about that before, just kind of thinking about all the times when you have literally navigated adversity. You know, and that's very different from just getting on with things and ignoring it. It's about, what can I do with this stuff showing up? And sometimes we do end up doing things, don't we?
And it's also where, if people are going to access the resources, you know, we talk a lot about that part of us that allows us to keep going and the part that can connect with a bit of acceptance and connect with a bit of resilience.
Yeah.
And that is there for a lot of people with endometriosis, whether they recognize it or not. Because, you know, we're not all over giving up and not doing things. People are achieving incredible things. And I think sometimes that can teeter towards criticism. Like, I know I would push myself very hard, and I used to tell myself that it needed to be that way because otherwise I wouldn't do anything. So I had to be hard on myself, and I had to push and I had to keep going.
And more of a rule-bound kind of way.
Yeah, and it could tip into a more critical kind of voice, like, you know, you're weak, you have to push harder, you have to try harder, you're not as good as other people if you don't do this. And I think it's recognizing that that might drive you on in certain forms, but it also can disconnect you from being able to take the time that you need. But most of us have got some kind of inner champion that we can hopefully work with, and maybe rephrase and maybe reframe and help to have a more compassionate element to that, so that we can still achieve stuff and do things that are important to us, but we're just looking at doing it differently.
Yes. Yeah. I like that. That's one thing people can take away from today, isn't it? That A, buy the book, which we'll come on to in a second, where people can find you and it. But just looking at things differently. But also those people who don't have endometriosis, whether they can take the time, if they have friends, relatives, people they know, people they work with, that they can take the time maybe to learn and look at it differently as well.
And everybody knows somebody who has a period. Yeah. Everybody. Yeah. Everybody knows somebody who menstruates. So whether it's endometriosis or whether it isn't, there's loads of gynecological conditions that overlap. Yeah. But also just the experience of having a menstrual cycle is important and has an impact. You know, I didn't even really know when I was young that you had a menstrual cycle. I knew you had a period for a week in a month, but I thought that was it, that you had your period and then it was over. And then you had 3 weeks or whatever about that, where you just, everything went back to normal. And then you had another period again. But you don't, you have a menstrual cycle. And that cycle's constantly changing, and you were always in that menstrual cycle at some point. And in the book, I talk about it as changing seasons. But that's happening all the time. So if you are somebody out there who doesn't menstruate, but you know somebody that does, it's worth knowing about this stuff. It's worth finding out, just so you've got some understanding about what it's like to live within a cyclical kind of biology.
And if you're not sure, go learn about it. Ask
questions. Because that isn't the same for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's that that's a really good point. Them. Yeah. Yeah. That we're not all the same either. That what one woman goes through won't be the same as what another does as well. So people are going to want to find out more about you. Let's start with your book. Where can we find it?
So I think you can find it everywhere now. It's on Amazon. You can buy it from the publisher. If you Google it, it's, you know, it will pop up, but we can put a link to the book with this podcast. But it's called Coping with Endometriosis, Bringing Compassion to Pain, Shame and Uncertainty.
Love that title.
Yeah. So you will find it on all good bookstores, I suppose.
Put that in our show notes as well. And where do you hang out? Are you on socials? Where can people find more? Because they're going to want to know more about
you. So I'm on Instagram in my professional capacity. So it's at Dr_K_Harris, which I now realize is not that catchy. But I didn't think of that when I set it up, and I'm sticking with it.
Join the club, yeah.
So yeah, so you'll find me on there, and you'll find me on LinkedIn as well.
So I'll make sure all of that's in our show notes, and we'll keep them live. So if anything else comes along, we can add those on as well. Now, I always ask every guest, we've had so many nuggets of wisdom. If there was one adversity takeaway you could leave us with, what might that be? One little extra nugget of wisdom.
I think it would just be the permission to understand your own experience and to take ownership of it. Because I don't think anybody ever gave me permission to actually understand what it was, and certainly didn't have permission to challenge it or change it. And you can accept it or not, your choice.
Yeah. So when you're dealing with a condition where sometimes a lot of control is taken away from you, that's where you do have some control, don't you? To say as well.
I was just going to say, like, I think people out there who are experiencing something like you. Yeah. Because, you know, it makes me feel really old to say I grew up without the internet. But the I do remember the internet coming in, and, you know, it certainly wasn't, you couldn't access the kind of support you can access now. Yes. And we know that online support also can have its downsides. And but I think find the things that are helpful to you and connect with those and ignore the ones that aren't. But there's a lot out there now to help people.
Which is just so incredible.
And if you found this, then you've probably got the knack of it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we'll make sure in the socials as well, in the show notes, we can add some of those organisations in as well, so people can just click. I always think that's easier than having to go Google it. They can just click a link.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make it easy for people. Kirsty, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much. I'm going to talk about my journey a bit more after today, definitely, because I just think, you know, if we have a little platform and a voice, why not use it to start to help other people, even if it's just helping them think about it before they take any next steps. Thank you so much. It's been brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. All right.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quintarillo, and it's been lovely having you along to listen to this episode. If you want to find more about me, you can find me at drtara.co.uk. So you'll see everything I'm up to, my media work, my collaborations, my clinical work, if you're interested in that. And of course, all the other episodes of the Adversity Psychologist podcast. If you're interested in coming on, you can also contact me and let me know what you would like to come and talk about. I'd love to hear from you.